You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. On this week's show, we're looking at the first three volumes in the DFC library, a new range of children's books that combines the quality of European graphic albums with the best of British comic storytelling. All of the books present longer narratives from the children's comic The DFC, which ran from 2008 to 2009. And on tonight's show, I'm talking to three of the creators of those strips. Ben Haggerty, the writer of Mezzolith, Dave Shelton, the creator of Good Dog, Bad Dog, and Kate Brown, the creator of The Spider-Moon.
First of all, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
It's been a year since the last issue of the DFC, and now we have the DFC Library, a new range of hardback books. I mean, obviously, in that period of time that's passed, you've probably gone from a sense of disappointment to actually a sense of relief that your work is now possibly reaching a larger audience and in a format that actually has a greater shelf life, for want of a better word. First to be published, I suppose, is Good Dog, Bad Dog. So if you want to go first, Dave.
Yeah, the sense of disappointment probably rather preceded the end of the DFC anyway, because we kind of had an inkling that it was troubled a while before it went. So we had time to prepare ourselves to some degree. And it was all part of the shame of it closing was always that there was this tremendous stock of high quality stories and artwork that just hadn't found the audience they deserved. And I think we're all hoping not only for success for our own volumes in the DFC library, we're very much hoping that the series as a whole is a great success to kind of pay back David for his faith in us all and in the medium, really, because he's a tremendous enthusiast for the medium. And when David Fickling gets enthusiastic about something, you really know about it.
Yeah. I mean, Kate, I suppose you've had the most experience of graphic novel publishing because your contribution to the Manga Shakespeare line, but it's a very different prospect, the Spider-Moon collection, because it's a lavish hardback in the graphic album format. And when I spoke to you a couple of years ago, I remember you saying that you were very much into European comics, so this must have fulfilled, in a way, one of your ambitions when you were creating it to start off with.
Definitely, I think for me, because I enjoy both writing and drawing, ending up doing something like this was definitely, as you say, fulfilling an ambition.
And looking at the range of books that's come out, I suppose it reflects very much the diversity of the DFC in its original incarnation, that you would get adventure strips next to gag strips, and very much a mixture of different creators as well. I mean, Kate, you come from the small press. Ben, you come from a non-comics background. I mean, what was the experience like when David Fickling first approached you to contribute to the comic? Were you surprised, or had you been in talks with him in the first place to do something published?
Well, for me, this is also a dream come true, because I'm a comics enthusiast. I grew up on the Hotspur and Action Man comics and war, battle, this, that and the other, commando stuff. And in fact, David didn't approach me, he approached Adam. He was looking for artists, and Adam is an extremely gifted artist, but he's a very close friend of mine, and we had for many years wanted to collaborate on something, and we kept thinking about a film. But of course, films are massively expensive, and when he got the call from David, he immediately called me, and I went, well, hey, this is fantastic, because for me, the story is not really about words. I'm not a wordsmith. I trained as an image maker with a theatre company, and all my storytelling is really based around picture. And I've been able, in a wonderful way, to really collaborate with Adam, and to really, behind every single one of these panels, there's at least 1,000 words of discussion and creation and shaping. And so it's a meeting of both of us. It really has been a dream, because what he's managed to put down there is very close to what I see in my mind when I'm telling these stories. So it's really been a privilege and honor, and I'm very excited.
And in creating Mezzolith, how many different ideas did you go through before pitching this one to David as the idea that would go forward into the comic?
Well, first I had to, the idea was there, so Adam and I discussed various different stories that I knew, scenarios that I had, and quite quickly we came up with the Mesolithic world. And how we sort of sold it to David was, we presented him with 3 pages of artwork, and the wonderful Ben Sharp, who was helping him, jumped out of his seat when he saw them. And it was sort of sealed at that moment there. But David made some very good editorial interventions right at the beginning about the need to create a context for all these stories, and I think if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't have given birth to Poika and his family. In fact, it was just going to be stories told but without a context, so that was a major constructive input as well from a, you know, very brilliant mind.
Like I said, looking at the 3 books here, they're very different types of comics, they're very different types of storytelling. Dave, when it came to your contribution, how did you first get involved with the project, and what led to Good Dog, Bad Dog being the comic strip that you saw print in the DFC?
I'd heard about the DFC through an illustrator called Joel Stewart, who put me in touch with David and Ben over a year before the DFC came out. I think there was a lot of pre-production. I had a meeting then, and there was general enthusiasm for me being involved, and then I disappeared off the planet for about a year before I thought to get back in touch. But I jumped through a few hoops and proposed an entirely different story, which had been accepted and contracted, and I was all set to go on that when the possibility of doing something that would appear in The Guardian as well came up, but what I was previously working on wouldn't fit that format. They said, "Well, can you go?" Lovely Ben Sharp said to me, "You can be in The Guardian. Can you come up with a whole new idea sometime in the next, I think I had about a week or two to come up with something." I pitched, I think, originally 3 ideas at him, and he'd blown 2 out of the water entirely and gone with this other one, which now was falling by the wayside. I had nothing in the store, kind of thing. I just went to an old sketchbook for inspiration, thinking that there'd be a drawing of a character or something that I could turn into something. And I found just the phrase, Good Dog, Bad Dog, which I'd written down because I'd been, for a short while, living in a house where the landlady had 2 dogs, one of which I liked and one of which I didn't. And it just occurred to me as a good title, but I had nothing to go with it at all. And I turned that into about a 3-line pitch to Ben, saying, well, I like film noir, so it's the detective thing, and they're dog detectives, and they're on the trail of the Golden Bone of Alexandria. How's that? And they ran, I think they ran that by The Guardian, and they said, fine. And Ben said, fine. Which meant I had to do the rest of it then. And whereas the other idea I'd been working on had been, I think, quite laboured and was suffering for it. This was done much more on the fly. And although there are bits of drawing where I think, oh, if only I'd had time to fix that, I think there's a spontaneity to the best bits of the stories that wouldn't have been there without. So it was... The shorter answer, the much shorter answer, is desperation and deadlines and panic was where the ideas came from. But it's, essentially, the premise of dogs came from having written down this title, and it being detectives came from just a love of noir and wanting to do something vaguely noir-influenced, albeit aimed at kind of 9 to 12-year-olds or whatever we were meant to be aiming at. I was never quite sure and never really paid much attention to that. So that was the gist of it.
Because I was looking at your blog online, and there are quite a few examples of your sketchbook on there, and it shows that you obviously have a great variety of different styles. So when it came to doing Big Dog, Little Dog, I guess you went for a more cartoony look. And I was wondering if that was partly because David Frickling wanted a huge variety of different kind of strips, and maybe because, for example, Ben and Kate strips were adventure stories. The idea of you doing a gag strip, albeit one that also told a narrative, was perhaps appealing to add to the mix.
It may have been. There was no... For me, anyway, there was no real direction about what might... It was infuriating and very freeing at the same time. There's no kind of... We've got this kind of strip and this kind of strip and this kind of strip. What we need is this kind of strip. It was just, what do you want to do? And you did kind of want a bit of a hint as to, you know, we've already got two pirate strips, so don't pitch that or whatever. Mm. But at the same time, incredibly freeing to just be, you know, what do you want to do? We'll consider anything kind of thing. So there was, if there was any of that, it wasn't expressed to me, and I suspect to none of the other creators. It was, again, David has a very strong belief in storytelling and in creators being left to do their bit, and then he does his bit after.
Hmm. Kate, when it came to creating the Spider Moon, did you audition various ideas to David, or was that the first one you came up with that you thought this is a really strong idea and I can run with it?
No, it wasn't the first thing that I pitched to. It was Ben and Will that I spoke with mainly. Mm. I'd initially gone for a kind of probably aimed at slightly younger children, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was like a story about like a boy and a little ghost girl that he finds in his wardrobe. but it was they decided that it was perhaps a little bit too gentle and suggested I try something more like an adventure story, because I'd expressed love for old, you know, 80s cartoons like mm-hmm. Serious Cities of Gold and stuff like that. So I sort of tried to think up something more along those sort of lines, and Spider-Man came out of that, really.
Mm. Well, when we spoke about your work a couple of years ago, the first installment of the Spider-Moon hadn't come out yet.
Mm.
And I remember we spoke about how your work appeared to be a combination of manga influences and children's illustration. But
yeah,
seeing the Spider-Moon as an album, I can also see a rich heritage of European comics, particularly the work of Moebius and Winsor McCay. And I was wondering if either of them were influences when it came to your storytelling.
Okay, sort of. I mean, we covered a lot of European comics when I was at university. I think I spoke to you a little bit about it last time. My tutor was very sort of pro-European comics, and they were, definitely those kind of things were definitely an influence to me, because especially in the UK, it's difficult to find things other than, you walk into your local newsagents and it's hard to find comics that aren't, you know, franchise stuff. So seeing all these new kind of things was really, really inspiring to me at the time. And it wasn't long after that Spider-Man got started, really. So, yeah, they probably were a big influence.
Because one of the things that is really interesting seeing Spider-Moon as a collection is the way that you have various artistic devices that weave in and out of the narrative. For example, the panels being tied to the page with rope, and then sort of little sprocket holes and things like that, as if you're adding an additional layer of decoration to make the page interesting as a holistic whole, as well as something that tells a narrative.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed doing those. I think that they were sort of a stylistic device that came out of doing Midsummer Night's Dream, which was really quite decorative. And I wanted to keep some decorative elements in Spider-Moon, but I didn't want to overload it. I didn't want to, do anything really, really obscure or random, because I was quite aware that it would be people who weren't, comics readers reading the DFC. It might be people picking up, you know, their very first comic ever, and I wanted to make sure it was easy to read, but still, you know, I had fun putting in things like the ropes and the chains and stuff like that as well.
I mean, Ben, when it came to writing your first comic, how much of it was written in a sort of script format, i.e., I want the following panel to contain the following image and the following words, or did you just write the story and let the artist?
No, it was very scripted.
Okay.
Because my club, the Crick Crack Club, we had put Alan Moore on actually about 20 years ago. He gave a talk, and he was talking about the importance of what's happening in the background, and you can tell several stories simultaneously. And so all the way through this, if you look carefully, there's quite a lot of playing with time and simultaneity by using the background and by using the shadows and all sorts of things. So I would write it initially, then Adam would respond, and sometimes I'd say, this is a chase sequence or something, can you do that in three panels? Because we've not got very much space. And for me, the whole drama of picture books, I was raised on the sort of glorious flourishing of the picture book rather than the comic, actually, as a child in the early 60s. And the whole joy is what happens when you turn the page. I'm really into the page turn as a participatory activity and as a shock. So page turns and all that sort of stuff. It's basic stuff, but it's terribly good for storytelling. Mm. And my job is as an oral storyteller, and I'm an improviser. And I work very much off, I know what's going to happen in the story, but I work off my mood and I work off the audience and the time of day and the location and the context. And so this was very much an opposite experience, because here was a chance to give a story a tangible form, and once it's decided, it's decided. But also with the DFC, David had talked about it actually as a television station. And when we were discussing the genres that he had, they've talked about pirates and things, but he said, could you do a war story? And I said, I don't think so. I said, I could do horror, though. He said, oh, yes, horror. Let's have some horror. So we took permission there to go for the sort of top end of the age group. It was fun to write this material and give it a form. But the discipline was five pages. It was to come out in five-page episodes. So that gives a slightly frenetic quality to the storytelling, actually. And so what we're very happy about with the book is that we've been able to do things like insert blank black pages as chapter breaks and things to just give the sense of time passing. Because in the structure of the story, it was always conceived as being a year from spring to spring. And so the book form has given us some chances to add additional stuff, which makes the sort of flow of the whole story much clearer than I think perhaps it was in the comic.
And how much of the story of Mesolith was serialized in the DFC? Is everything that's in this book in the comic, or did you get to say issue 43 and there are another six installments to go?
No, we'd got it all finished within the opening and the ending of the comic. I mean, you know, we have an enormous plan for the continuation of the story, and we've put seeds left, right and centre in it for directions in which it could go. And hopefully, if these books move and the series is a success, then hopefully a second edition, a second book will be commissioned.
I mean, that's something that's notable actually with all three books, that there are chapter breaks, but presumably with all three strips they ran continuously for a set amount of time, and so in a way the book is unrepresentative of how it was originally read, which must both have its benefits, like you said, and its drawbacks, because you planned it to run in a sort of a weekly format, but now it's being read in one chunk. I mean, for example, Dave, when it came to doing something that has a narrative as well as comedy elements, the idea of breaking something up with cliffhangers, with turning the page to reveal a joke and so on, how did you feel that, find that experience?
I was fine with the page turning thing. The having three page episodes was more of a challenge. And largely my solution to that was to cram more panels on a page. So it just I think I did through like 17 panels on one page at one point, which was foolish. There's not, there was a certain amount of work in although it is all the same stories as were in the DFC or in the book, there was a certain amount of jiggery-pokery to fill in some gaps and kind of make those jolts from the end of one chapter to the beginning of another not so noticeable. So there's the odd extra panel and a bit of kind of shuffling around of panels to make them all fit. But in terms of the page turny bits, that's one of the things that's there as you create comics that you use, as Ben was saying. And it's I hadn't done too much in terms of now I think about it, I must have some left hand pages that are now on right hand pages in the book, but I don't think it matters too much. And I took account of that to some degree as I reformatted. And it's fine.
Well, I was reading a review of Good Dog, Bad Dog on the Forbidden Planet International blog.
He was very kind.
No, I mean, I totally agree with him that Richard was saying that obviously one of the most important qualities of a comedy story, be it, you know, film, cartoon, strip, is that it makes you laugh on regular occasions, and certainly Good Dog, Bad Dog does. And I think, if nothing else, and I think it's very successful on all sorts of levels, but if nothing else, it did make me laugh every few pages, which I thought was great.
That's very gratifying. The thing that I loved him saying was he commented on the comic timing of it, and that made me prouder than anything, really, particularly because I think Paul Gravett mentioned when it first come out that you don't often see people trying to do the kind of slapstick I was occasionally attempting in Good Dog, Bad Dog in comics, and having done a bit of it now, I can see why people don't do it very often, because it's quite, or at least I find it hard, I find it all a bit hard, but I found the kind of engineering of that particularly kind of labour intensive. And so to have somebody say, yeah, you pulled it off, I was very pleased.
Kate, when it came to your experience of serialising the original strip, what was it like breaking it up into, I mean, how many pages did you get at a time? 3, 4, 5?
It was 5 for the first series, and then it was 4 for the second part. And yeah, breaking it up was really, really challenging. I'd done a lot of short comics, and I'd written a lot of long comics, but I'd never written and drawn a sort of long, ongoing, short comic title thing. So it was definitely, an interesting way, a very unique way to work. I think had I worked on the thing as just one long, continuous story without all the breaks, it probably would have been quite different as a tale. I think the structuring it like that really influenced how it was produced and what happened and when things happened in it and that kind of thing.
Because it does read very coherently as a book.
Does it? But,
although I'd say in one respect, the collection of The Spider Moon is the most frustrating of these three DFC books, because unlike the other two, it is very much to be continued.
Yeah, Richard Bruton said that as well.
But at the same time, I suppose you've had the most exposure of any of the DFC creators, because you adapted Spider Moon for the stage last year, and then more recently you won a graphic novelist's prize, both of which must have, you know, garnered you considerably more attention than you were expecting.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the stage play was really brilliant. The people at Playbox were extremely lovely, friendly people who were really, really into the DFC for a start. They were really, really supportive of it, and just really excited about storytelling in general. And it's kind of good closure for me, because I was kind of able to see the whole, because they did the whole story as a play, so I was able to see that, which was great. I still feel a bit sort of flabbergasted and overwhelmed about everything that's kind of happened recently.
So did the play continue beyond even the last strip that was printed in the DFC?
It did, yeah. It was they did the whole story. So from they included the bits that were drawn, and then because I sort of left them my notes and explained to them what I'd planned to happen for the story, they went on and sort of produced the whole thing, and they had a conclusion and everything. It was really great.
Mm. And like I said, you won the Graphic Novelist Prize.
Yeah.
That must have been not only great affirmation for you as a creator, but also the DFC project as a whole, that David was able to get all these creators together that were such top talent as far as, you know, the British comics industry is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, with the Arts Foundation Award, I was totally nuts. I was I'm still really I still don't really know what to think or say about that. Yeah, I mean, I always felt like I was a bit of a newbie doing the DFC and stuff. I felt, you know, like I really had to give it as much as I could to try and you know, sort of prove that I could at least do something. I mean, I always felt really grateful that they, you know, sort of taken a chance on me and on a lot of things. I think the majority of the strips in there were really bold and really inventive, and I really praise the DFC and David and the whole DFC team for doing what they did.
Hmm. I think one thing that's interesting, particularly to see both Mezzolith and Spider Moon in print almost simultaneously, is that your story is actual fantasy. It has people with wings, as kind of a Flash Gordon for girls vibe, if that's okay as a description. Well, Ben, your script, although it is fantasy from the outset, the more you think about it, all of the fantastical elements are actually stories within the story. So it might only be the real world, and all the elements that we see of as being monsters may only be in people's minds.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been interested in traditional stories, folk tales, fairy tales, epics, myths, all my life. And we don't have a common shared culture, or if it is, it's so fragmented, it's very difficult to find a collective influence upon society. Mm. Whereas in my life, I've been fortunate and met various people from, or representatives of various hunter-gatherer still existing tribal groups in India and in the Americas. And there is still a sense of cohesion there that if we're traumatized, we still know our nightmares are still referencing one coherent body of ideas and one coherent imaginative world. So what I've tried to do here is really dig into the archaeology, not only of the people and the time, and this is all set on the northeast Yorkshire coast, and the archaeology is as accurate as we could make it. For instance, during the writing of it, they discovered some new buildings, and we had to abandon one type of building and find something much more permanent. Mm. And that's sort of up-to-date archaeological information in there. But really what I was looking at was the archaeology of the imagination. And there are four, at least, traditional stories buried in this. Mm. And I got into this way of finding, you know, the imagination can set a story in, clad it in almost any time, any country. And so I was taking stories that I liked and then dropping them back to the Middle Ages, dropping them back to the Iron Age, dropping them back to the Bronze Age, dropping them back to the Neolithic, and some could drop right back to hunter-gatherer times. There's no need for agriculture or the city or merchants or all these sort of things. And then, having identified those stories, I would go and look at hunter-gatherer narratives recorded in places like New Guinea and all over the world, and sure enough, there you would find the Swan Maidens or whatever, right across the world. So what I was looking for was really the oldest stories that human beings have, and in here there's a story about an abandoned baby which then comes and devours everybody. Well, I heard that as an urban legend of a baby abandoned in a plastic bag in a skip in Manchester. And yet you can find it right across the world. It's an extraordinarily old idea.
And when you've done research about the history of oral storytelling, would stories be told to people in one chunk, or were they also serialized? You know, sort of, I don't know, people would gather
round the campfire for a village meeting or a feast once a week, and they'd get an instalment and then have to wait?
I think it's a sort of both and, not an either or, and it depends on which sort of society. I mean, you know, there are still to this day in the Storytellers Market in Marrakesh, storytellers who come down from the mountains, a group of people sit around them and they start to tell a story, and then they stop at a dramatic moment, and then they put their hat on the ground and some coins go into it, and then they continue. So it's coming out as a commercial narrative with drama, just as you have in a soap opera. But on the other hand, I mean, if we think of the, for instance, in our culture, there is this Christian myth lurking in the background, but very often we don't really pick it up as one long narrative. You encounter it at different times across the year in various festivals and forms. And I think that from my experience in India, that's nobody can tell you the one story of the Indian gods, but they can tell you bits. And I think if they were to sit down, they would realize that they did know it as a linear narrative, but they've just absorbed episodes. And because they're attached to festivals or times of the year, you meet it, you know, maybe 60, 70 times in your life, if you're lucky. And each time it means something more to you. So I've also worked in Mesolith on creating the different contexts in which there is storytelling. So at one point you can see a formal storyteller performing to the whole of the group there in the background, but most of the stories are told rather on the side and obliquely.
Well, I think it's very interesting that all three of these books tap into sort of narratives that we're all familiar with at different levels. You know, you've spoken about classical myths and the history of oral storytelling. I mean, Dave, with your book, you've spoken about slapstick comedy. There's obviously that noir influence. So I think in terms of, obviously, there isn't a DFC universe, as people like to talk about, you know, other publishers' comics. But
although that would be interesting.
Yes, I don't know how on earth you'd possibly reconcile that. Maybe one thing playing on a TV and another character's, you know, environment or whatever. But when it came to conjuring this mixture of slapstick and noir, how much of it was sort of remembered tropes from films that you saw 20 years ago, and how much of it was you thinking, I need to watch a bogey film now in order to do another installment?
You know, I can't remember for sure. I watched a certain amount of stuff just to kind of absorb it as I was working, but there's not a lot of direct lifts homages. I remember watching. I think I took a tiny bit of a street scene from pretty directly from Lost Weekend. And there's odd bits of just kind of, because I'm bad at streets, so there's a certain amount of just sort of period detail I pulled from that. But in terms of the storylines, they were done very much on the fly, particularly with Golden Bone of Alexandria, the first one I produced, with a very, very loose kind of, this happens in episode one, this happens in episode two, sort of a plan, which I more or less stuck to. But all of the details and much of the character development, such as there is any, and much of the plot, again, such as there is any, was created as I went along, but especially on that first one, that's sort of a little more disciplined with the other long story, Dog's Dinner. But in terms... It was never going to be taking that much from noir anyway, because what I like about noir in many ways is the stuff that you don't want to be throwing at the audience of the DFC. I think, although having said that, the darkness in Mesolith is magnificent and wonderful and absolutely works. So possibly I could have got away with more had I wished to. But then again, I was trying to play it for laughs. So.
With possibly an adult sitting over the child's shoulder and giggling along, because I was thinking of your reference to Hopper's painting as well.
Oh, yeah. I remember as I did that, I thought, well, this is such a cliché to reference Nighthawks. And I thought, but it's not a cliché to nine-year-olds.
Exactly.
So it's, again, tremendously freeing, because you think, well, not that I wanted to kind of spray cliches at children, but I think I can allow myself that. And it was fun to do.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, at the start of the 21st century, so many cultural artifacts from the 20th century have become almost part of a collective subconscious. The idea of you tapping into noir tropes, the idea of Kate's story reminding me of Flash Gordon, but not necessarily other people, you know, coming at it from having watched probably too much science fiction and fantasy. And particularly children, you know, won't have all of these cultural references. And so mixing all of these strips into a stew that tell all sorts of different stories, I think, is one thing that not only made the DSC successful as a critic, maybe not in terms of sales, as an original, in its original format, and also in these books, the fact that there are so many different things going on that can appeal to so many different people.
Yeah, I think that was kind of a strength and a weakness at the same time in some ways, in that for me, there's a tremendous quality to the material there, but possibly the DFC as a whole slightly lacked identity, because it was great at the same time that it could do that, and it was, and I think it was beginning to settle into something towards the end of its run. Mm. It was actually rather better just before it got cancelled than it had been right at the start, maybe.
The launch of the library is very exciting.
Definitely.
I went into David's office a couple of weeks ago, and it was the first time I saw all three books lying on the table together, and I felt a very strange and strong greed arise inside me, and I was looking through the eyes of an 8 or 9 year old thinking, collect, I like those. And I think, you know, that there is going to be something for all tastes, and I think people have definitely got, you know, a right to have favourites amongst all these strips. But I think as a sort of a package, as something that children can encounter, a phenomena, here is a source of good stories, good art, something rich that has quality, definite British creative quality in it, I think it's a very exciting product that's being produced. And I think it's got an artistic creative integrity to it. And I think that... as Kate said, that David's sort of light touch editorial involvement is really wonderful. We're not working for franchises. We've been given incredible freedom to express what we need to express.
Well, and hopefully these three books will sell in huge enough numbers that there'll be not only lots of future volumes, but they'll come out more frequently. Because, like I said, you know, Kate, with your volume, it ends on a cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. And it's very unfair to the audience. They're going to have to wait at least a year for the next book.
I guess that's going to be the case for quite a few of the strips, should they hopefully make book forms. I mean, so many of them were planned to be long-running, ongoing series with long story arcs. I mean, I really hope that, you know, we can see all of them one day in one... on one sort of huge shelf.
Well, all I can say is fingers crossed, because they are lovely books. Thank you, Kate, and thank you, Dave, for joining me on the phone, and Ben in the studio.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Bye. For more information about all three of the books we've discussed in today's show, please visit our blog on www.panelborders.wordpress.com.
Thanks for listening.